Austin.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook.
We take every threat seriously. And the American people shouldn't be surprised that we are issuing alerts. After all, on our TV screens the other day, we saw the evil one threatening, calling for more destruction and death in America.
People should not overreact to this. They should realize that given all of the events that have occurred, particularly September 11 and the things after that, when we have situations like this, everybody wants to go the extra length, particularly all of the health agencies, to make sure that that there are no problems. And much of this is being done to allay people's fears.
Over and over again, the government has told us, don't panic. But it's not easy to keep cool. Not when an NBC employee has tested positive for anthrax, when the FBI warns of new terror attacks, when water system operators ask for billions of federal dollars to protect drinking water. Panic is a tempting reaction. In this hour, we'll be talking about living in a culture of panic. But first, the country is on high alert. The FBI has warned Americans that there may be further terrorist attacks over the next several days, domestically or against U.S. interests abroad. Officials won't discuss the nature of the threat, but said it was a credible threat and reported received by the CIA. Reporter Josh Meyer has been following the story for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us from the newspaper's Washington Bureau. Hello, Josh.
Hi, Tom.
Josh, the Bush administration has been beating the drum for 2 days about impending attacks. Where does this threat come from? How credible is it?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, they've been warning pretty much since the September 11th attacks about some kind of threat. And then intelligence community representatives have said in the last week or so that there's much more specific threats out there, specific and credible threats that something is coming very soon. But they won't say where it's coming from or when or in what form.
Is there any insight into what's prompting these pretty significant national alerts?
Well, it certainly is unprecedented, so you have to believe that they have some kind of a specific information. We've talked to people in the intelligence community and in the law enforcement community, and all of them say that, yes, there are some specific and credible threats out there, but they're just not going to tell us what they are. At the same time, however, they're saying that they don't know exactly where it's going to come from or when or in what form, like I said. So I think they're pretty nervous about it as well, and certainly conveying that alarm to the general public.
It's difficult for the public when there's no location or more specific time attached to it. I mean, it could be California, New York, Beirut, it could be anywhere.
Well, I'm getting emails from people all around the world, people I know, people I don't know, asking me what's going on. Is it going to be a bioterrorist threat, a chemical attack? What kind of attack? And, you know, I've never seen anything like this where the administration basically says, you need to really worry, but we're not going to tell you what to worry about.
And, of course, it could end up being nothing at all.
It could be, and let's hope it is. But and maybe the preparation and all the awareness of what may be out there might be helping, or maybe it'll blow over. The most disconcerting thing is I've been covering terrorism now for a while, and for instance, one of the terrorists who testified about the bin Laden training camps said that the second wave could come 3 or 4 months after the first wave. It could come later. It could come next week. I almost hate to say that because I think it really scares people, but people have to be vigilant that something may come up even if it doesn't come up in the next day or two.
Josh, where does the overall investigation of the September 11 attacks stand? When might we see some arrests that could pull the teeth of the organization making these threats?
Well, they've arrested or detained several hundred people. I think that the number just grew today by several dozen as well, according to John Ashcroft. But whether they're actually going to indict people, that could take weeks or months. It may take even longer. Clearly, right now, though, they are looking at some people as specific and credible suspects or accomplices that helped the 19 people that have already been accused of being the hijackers who perished on the flights.
We have a sense of a lot of people being swept up, but have there been any arrests off of the most wanted terrorist list? Why are these terrorist cells so hard to track down and crack?
Well, that's sort of there's several answers for that. The first answer is that, yes, they do believe. We have some inside information as to who they're rounding up, and they've certainly polygraphed a lot of people. They've detained people that they believe are specifically connected to this plot, people that have sent emails, people that shared apartments with the suspects, and so on and so forth. But the changing nature of terrorism makes it almost impossible to determine who exactly is a terrorist and who may be somebody who's an accomplice or who's somebody that's providing logistical or financial support. As one FBI guy told me, it's almost impossible to draw the line between who is criminally culpable in a conspiracy and who is just sort of helping out.
Mm-hmm. Today, another anthrax case popped up in New York. An NBC Nightly News employee tested positive for skin anthrax.
Right.
We've also heard reports about an anthrax scare at the New York Times. What's the story there?
Well, I mean, every reporter in the United States that's covering this stuff is pretty unglued about this. One of the reporters for the New York Times, I probably shouldn't mention her name, but she is their terrorism writer. She also just wrote a book on germ warfare, and she got a letter addressed to her. Apparently, that letter was from St. Petersburg, Florida, which is the same place where the letter to NBC was sent from, and also where the anthrax scare in Florida is. And interestingly enough, where a lot of the hijackers had been training on how to fly planes. But some authorities are saying that there's no connection. Some are saying they're still investigating it, but they're leaving a big question mark out there as to what's going on. I know at the LA Times, we've been told not to open any mail for the next couple of days.
Josh, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Josh Meyer has been covering the FBI investigation for the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from their Washington bureau. With each new case of anthrax, investigators have emphasized that there's no evidence that they're tied to terrorist activities. But the cases in Florida and New York are linked in that anthrax exposure is showing up among people who work for news organizations. Joining us now is biochemist Rocco Casagrande. He works for Surface Logics in Brighton, Massachusetts. Currently, he's developing a detector for airborne pathogens such as anthrax. Good evening, Rocco Casagrande.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Good to have you. Thanks for joining us. Do these current anthrax attacks look like bioterrorism to you? What else could they be?
Well, that's exactly the point. If you look at the casualties from anthrax in the last century in the United States, by far, most of them were cutaneous. People developed skin lesions with anthrax in them.
Mm-hmm.
There were only 18 cases of people getting inhalational anthrax where they breathed in spores. And of those, two of them were laboratory workers who worked with the spores, and 16 of them were mill workers who worked with goat hair and a lot of other textiles that tend to accumulate anthrax from the environment.
So what do you take away from that?
Well, seeing it in a newspaper worker is very unusual, extremely unusual.
Therefore, does it look like a terrorist effort could be behind it, or could this just be a single sick individual?
There's no way to tell. There's no evidence for that. There was no letter claiming responsibility. There was no demands. There's no way. There's no evidence to guess either way.
Mm-hmm. What do these cases tell us about the difficulty of spreading anthrax? Why was the effect of the contamination, except in the case of 63-year-old Bob Stevens who died, but in the other cases, why was it so minimal?
Well, as we said before, it's very difficult to properly culture and mill anthrax into a dried powder and then disseminate it. This person or a group of people used a very crude method to get the anthrax to its victims. And basically, we're not sure what it is, mm-hmm. but it's possible that he just sent it to them as a powder.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, very few people were affected. This is the kind of thing we'd expect from a crude biological attack. You get five or fewer people, five or fewer casualties,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know that it happened until it's too late for some people.
How much sophistication does appear to have been required to mount these incidents?
Well, if the anthrax did come in as a dried powder, that requires quite a bit of technical sophistication to culture it and dry it down into a powder and mill it into a fine enough powder that can be dispersed in the air without killing the anthrax, without killing the bacterium itself.
So this would have to be someone with a scientific background.
I would say so, yes.
Mm. Rocco, what are the first symptoms of anthrax infection? Some of these people didn't seem to even know they had it.
That's right. Well, the primary symptoms are confused with flu, usually. You get fever. They often have vomiting. You have difficulty breathing. And then that's followed by a brief recovery and then significant respiratory distress leading to shock and death and internal hemorrhaging.
Mm. But in these cases, they appeared that they were stopping well short of that. Or would that have come later if they hadn't been discovered?
Oh, I see. Yeah, there's a vast difference between exposure to anthrax spores and actually the disease of anthrax. So there's the anthrax bacillus spores that can get into you and infect you, but not actually cause disease. You need approximately 10,000 spores in order to actually develop the disease anthrax.
So there's a low level of exposure that we can tolerate without getting sick, certainly without dying.
Quite true, yes. In fact, if you look at those mill workers that I was talking about before, on an average 8-hour shift, they would inhale about 400 spores without falling ill.
Is there anything that people can do to protect themselves or simply to feel less vulnerable?
Part of the problem with a biological attack is you don't know that it's going to happen. If you're exposed, you probably won't know what's going to happen. So going out to a store and buying a gas mask won't be of any help because you'd have to wear the gas mask 24 hours a day, and you have to eat, you have to drink. Mm-hmm. So that won't help. Basically, if you see any kind of powders in your mail or something like that, put it down and call the appropriate people. Call the FBI, and they'll put you in touch with the right people to have it tested.
If there's anything to take comfort here from, I suppose, it's that so very few people have been affected.
That and the fact that if you know you're exposed, mm-hmm. antibiotic treatment is very effective. If you get antibiotics before you develop symptoms, which takes many days for the spores to germinate inside your body, you have a very great chance of survival.
Thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thank you.
Rocco Casagrande is a biochemist for Surface Logix in Brighton, Massachusetts. A road race canceled by a vague fear in Washington, D.C. Anti-anthrax antibiotics flying off the shelves, fireworks that paralyze an entire town. There's a nagging tinge of panic in the air. That, of course, is what the terrorists want. The sad thing is, it works. We're looking this hour at the psychology of fear. Has fear changed your plans, your state of mind? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining us from the studios of KPPC in Los Angeles is Barry Glassner. He's professor of sociology at the University of Southern California and author of The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things. Welcome, Barry Glassner.
Thanks for inviting me.
Good to have you. Also joining us tonight from New Hampshire Public Radio is our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beattie. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Tom.
Barry Glassner, you've written in the past about the fixations Americans seem to have on threats that weren't really serious enough for all the time we spent thinking about them. Fear of flying, flesh-eating bacteria, workplace violence, pedophiles in cyberspace are some of those you've mentioned. But are we in a different situation now? Is a heightened degree of concern, even panic, reasonable now, or is it not?
Well, I think if there's any good news in the situation we're in right now, it's that we're focused on real dangers. I can turn on my local newscasts, even the local TV news, not just the networks, and hear real news. I mean, I think if we recall over the summer on clear through September 10th, had I done that, what I would have heard and seen is Gary Condit stories, stories about the missing interns, stories about shark attacks and so forth. Mm-hmm. Probably, any minor violence that occurs at a school would be blown out of proportion because we've been doing that for several years. So now at least we are focused on some real dangers. The unfortunate part, obviously, is that those dangers are quite serious and quite frightening. Now, should we panic, to go to that part of your question, to the extent that we're terrified, by definition, the terrorists win. And if we're terrified, it's in part because of the way we're responding collectively. I don't mean as individuals. We need to be careful not to to give way to that success that they're after. Mm-hmm. And I think that in many cases, we don't really need to have that reaction.
Jack Beattie, but you can feel it in the air, can't you? I mean, these reports pop off every few seconds, it seems, on the news now.
Yeah, there's a sort of running file of that. And as you watch one story, the reporter is talking, you can watch the crawl underneath with yet another tendril of this fear abroad. It's something when your worst fears come true. A psychiatrist friend of mine told me about a patient who was having severe paranoid attacks for years, and one of her fears was that the television was trying to tell her, that the newsmen were trying to tell her some terrible news. And when she woke up on September 11th, there was the terrible news. And it completely deranged her for a bit, and she had a terrible time. Well, of course, that's she's a little figure for us,
right.
Isn't she?
That's where we are now. We've had the terrible news. How are we going to deal with it? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. How is the news of the day affecting your everyday life, your view of the world, your feeling of security? Are you panicked? I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It's been a month and a day since the World Trade Center came down, since a plane crashed into the Pentagon, since we entered into a war on terrorism. There's anxiety about the future, and there are symptoms of panic everywhere. You see it in the way individuals react, the way the public at large reacts, the way local governments react.
Washington, D.C. Citing security concerns, the U.S. Army canceled the Army 10-miler road race, which was to start and finish at the Pentagon on Sunday.
Medford, Massachusetts. A fireworks display left residents momentarily frightened they might be victims of terrorist retaliation.
Salt Lake City, Dateline, October 10th. Horrified by last month's suicide hijackings, a new breed of traveler is in the skies. Passengers who vow to do whatever it takes or go down fighting, in the words of Gordon Langford.
Washington, D.C. Worried about terrorism, the nation's water system operators want $5 billion from Congress to protect drinking water and wastewater plants.
Boca Raton, Florida. Somebody is trying to murder people with germs, said Sal DiBello, 68, a retired travel agent who was in Walgreens Pharmacy lining up for Cipro this afternoon. I don't care whether they're Mideast terrorists or local crazies.
Have you thought about buying the antibiotic Cipro? Are we living in a culture of panic? What fans it, and how can it be stopped? We're here with Barry Glassner, a professor of sociology at the University of Southern California and author of The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things, and with our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Barry Glassner, this is a very difficult situation for the news media because on the one hand, no one wants to fan nervousness or panic. On the other hand, there are real events and developments that have to be reported. Our own president warning about potential terrorist attacks. Do you think we're striking the right balance in terms of the way we're discussing the threats that we're facing right now?
I think most of the media have been doing a very good job. I'm someone who is a media critic and doesn't often utter the sentence I just did. But I've been very impressed since September 11th, by and large. The exceptions, though, I think deserve some attention because I'm finding them more often now. And that is every time something comes up that could end up being consequential, it sounds as if it's consequential right away on some of the media outlets in particular, and I'm not going to name names, but in particular on some of the 24-hour news channels. I'll just give two very quick examples. The other day when there was a small plane that crashed, as it turned out, of course, it had nothing to do with terrorism. But you wouldn't know that from listening to the initial reports where there was a lot of speculation about whether that was so. So should we know that that a small plane went down when it goes down? I don't know. I think that's a complicated question. We certainly wouldn't have heard about it prior to September 11th. Is there good reason that we should hear about it immediately now? I don't know. I think that's a decision for news directors to make. But if they decide that there is good reason, then simply report what is known at that moment, which, by the way, as I noticed when I checked, NPR was doing immediately after this happened. Mm. The other example is obvious from this morning with the new anthrax case or exposure. There was a great variation in the reporting. If you listen to what the mayor of New York and the New York City police officials and others were saying, mm-hmm. they were saying very clearly there's no reason to worry. The situation's contained. Anthrax is treatable, that they frequently have received false reports in the past and so forth. Some of the initial reports and a lot of the kind of, shall we say, intonation and music mm-hmm. behind some of the reports mm-hmm. made it sound very, very terrifying from the get-go.
Jack Beatty, what's the sense you're getting with your exquisite antenna? Are we hitting the right balance of being informed and concerned, or are we somewhere on the line that's edging towards something less rational?
I hope not. Rational fear is, it has an object at least. The trouble with this, it's designed exquisitely as a toxin to democracy. fear is it kills public spaces. It gets us into our privatism. And one of the things that's happened since this attack is that we've been going out in public. We've been seeing each other. We've been going to vigils and demonstrations. We've been finding public life again. And terror and fear have a way, it can drive us back into privatism, and that can be bad. I mean, politically, fear has gone with authoritarianism and ultimately with fascism. Mm. It is a threat far worse than, it's a kind of anthrax to the body politic, if you will, and that's what really worries me about this.
Well, it is the case that the House today passed the anti-terrorism bill with many of the restraints on government power that had been negotiated into it taken back out. It's the harder version that's working its way through Congress now.
Yeah, and being fed clearly by the headlines. I mean, it would be a bold legislator who could sit there and say, no, I'm not going to vote for this. I have civil liberties qualms when his constituents are saying we want protection at all costs. But of course, some costs are just too high to pay. And that's why this is such an insidious threat to us.
We're talking about the level of fear in the air. Is it appropriate? Is it overblown? How do you feel in your personal life, in your personal circumstances? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Mary is on the line. Welcome, Mary. You're on the air.
Hi there, Tom. Thank you very much for taking the call. I just was listening to what Jack was saying, and I think it's Michael as well, and I'm trying to find my own balance. I'm in a fortunate position that I'm piggybacking between U.S. coverage and European coverage through the BBC and friends over there. And I just think it's very difficult for the American public who've never faced this kind of thing before in the numbers that they're facing it to try and separate out what is rational fear and what isn't. And I think to some degree, although I totally understand the government over here being very being very aware of what they share and don't share, I think they also have to find the balance between not panicking people unnecessarily and giving information that's going to allow people to make that rational choice.
Mary, you've lived then in the UK where there's been terrorist threat from the IRA and others. How do you think Americans are doing in striking the balance here?
I'm being very careful because I'm married to one. I think it's very difficult because the vast majority of Americans probably have not had as much exposure to things going on outside of the States as they have in the last month. And I've lived in Northern Ireland. I've been part of, you know, stuff over there for many years. And it's a very difficult thing to try, you know, in what is essentially a very large country but has sort of looked insular for quite some time, to suddenly be overwhelmed with all of the stuff that's happening.
We're working to get used to it, Mary. Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go right away to the phones again. Scott is on the line. Scott, welcome. You're on the air. Scott, do we have Scott? We may have lost him. Barry Glasner, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Talk to us for a minute about the dynamics of panic, the sociology of panic. How do these concerns get revved up to a point where they stop being rational and potentially begin being irrational?
Well, one thing that happens is that they build on each other, and especially through rumors, so that we hear from friends all sorts of stories. We open up our email, and there are all kinds of stories there. The one that's been going around lately is this friend of a friend letter. I don't know if you've been covering that. I don't want to help spread a rumor, but lots of people have received this email, and essentially it says that something's going to happen on Halloween, and that the person heard a friend of a friend.
Right.
And it's clearly making the rounds.
Rumor. What else works here?
Well, you know, so that adds – it kind of accumulates, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we have the facts of what's happening. Then we have the rumors added on to it. Then we talk with each other. I think where the panic starts to kick in is when people feel just sort of immobilized, you know, where we feel – Look, I'll just stay home. You know, I won't go out in the community. This is the only place I feel safe right now. And then what happens is that that feeds on itself. You know, social isolation is stressful in itself. It results in greater fear, especially if you're staying home and watching scary reporting on TV all the time. And so it just sort of builds on itself in that kind of way.
We're talking about fear, maybe even panic. Are you staying cool, or are you getting unnerved by the drumbeat of reports and warnings that all Americans are hearing every day? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Scott, we've got you on the line now, I hope. Welcome.
Taking my call. I managed to stay pretty cool myself, but I think that what I would say is that people don't really have the ability or the facts they need to make relative risk assessments, so they can't tell. So they don't think about what the probabilities are of X happening compared to Y, or getting anthrax compared to getting in a car accident. And I think that that's, you know, leading to a lot of the fear that's happening. And I think it's true to say that not only do people have in their minds what happened in New York and, you know, the actual cases of anthrax, but people also have in their mind all the warnings that have gone out. And so they think that it's almost as though those things have actually happened. They build up in the background. So people can't really make accurate assessments of probabilities. They don't sit around thinking, what's the chance of getting struck by lightning versus what's the chance of getting anthrax? So they go out and buy Cipro, and they go out and buy guns, and they go out and buy gas masks. And, it's oftentimes quite irrational. The chances are so minimal that anything would happen to them.
Mm, we've got it. Thanks for your call, Scott. Barry Glasner, I know you've looked at these odds of different sorts of events. In the past, you've compared them to some more mundane things. Now we've got terror as a new addition to the arsenal of things that could happen. But talk to us for a minute about probabilities.
Well, the points that Scott raised are exactly the right ones in this regard, let me say. He mentioned about automobile accidents. And something that's very clearly seems to be going on now is that people are canceling airplane reservations and packing the family up in the car or van to go on a long trip. Mm-hmm. When we do that, we greatly increase the likelihood of injury or death. There were about 40,000, more than 40,000 traffic fatalities last year. And so you can do some simple math here. We end up with a 20% increase in driving, we can expect
You can quickly do the math, and it multiplies.
Right, exactly. And so that really is literally irrational behavior. It's understandable because it's frightening to many people right now to fly, and we feel safer when we're behind the wheel of our car. Mm-hmm. But it is clearly irrational.
And yet we somehow, the images from September 11th and the horror of that day have increased national empathy for people who did suffer catastrophic consequences from terrorism in a way that seems to drive it into each of our lives. Don't you think, Jack, that somehow the very empathy that Americans have opened up around these attacks has made everything seem closer to us personally?
You know, that's an interesting way to put it. Paradoxically, we've left ourselves vulnerable to the emotion of empathy, of reaching out to these people, of identifying with them, of reading endlessly the obituaries and the details, the heroism, the suffering. And that, of course, has made us even sort of our ganglier are now more vulnerable than ever to this kind of thing, because we are open. You know, relative to this business of risk assessment, years ago on Otis Air Force Base, just before you'd leave the base, there was a great big sign that said, "You are about to enter the most dangerous place in the world, a public highway." And nothing has changed that, that's for sure.
Even September 11, in a way. We're talking about fear. We're talking about panic. Do you feel it? Do you reject it? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. There's a drumbeat of new developments coming out every day, it seems, and warnings from Washington and beyond. How is it affecting you? Alice is on the line. Welcome, Alice.
I lost an office buddy on Flight 11. I live about 25 miles southeast of Boston.
I'm sorry for that.
Yep. And so it brought it really you know, home to me, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to take my fear and turn it into some rational action, some of which I can do, but there are other things that would help our economy and make us safer that I wish our government would do. I used to work on nuclear control software for a nuclear plant.
All right.
And I live right between the Seabrook and the Pilgrim nuclear plants in Plymouth and Seabrook, New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that I could not help if somebody was to fly a plane into those places. And because I know about the software, we can make that control software safer. And this idea of having anti-aircraft or radar emplacements around such places, I don't think is overreacting.
So you live in between two nuclear power plants. You know the kind of software engaged in the controls, and you think there's room for improvement.
Definitely, because I'm also a military software engineer. We're always struggling to get the software out, you know, out the door as soon as possible. We could make it a lot safer, and we could make those controls able to respond and put those, you know what I'm talking about.
Alice, do you find yourself thinking more about the risk of some attack on those plants since September 11th?
Well, I try not to, simply because I think we've got a huge propaganda machine in this
mm-hmm.
country, and I disbelieve half of what I hear. But on the other hand, I am trying to do safe things, such as try to get independent supplies of water, similar to what we do when we're readying for a hurricane up
mm-hmm.
here,
mm-hmm.
and put them down there in the basement like I never have during hurricane warnings, because we've got the reservoirs, although a lot of small towns like my own, Canton, we also have wells.
Mm-hmm.
And all those guys have got to do is poison a few wells all over this country, and you know what we would have then, even more panic.
Well, Alice, it sounds like you're getting prepared and working like everyone to try and balance reasonable concern and fear. Barry Glasner, you hear there, this is the mind of America at work, trying to find the chinks in the armor, the vulnerabilities. Alice knows nuclear plants, and so her mind goes to thinking about those vulnerabilities.
It's very encouraging what she says she's buying, by the way, water. You know, we hear a lot of reports, and they apparently are quite reliable, that gas masks are being bought in large numbers, that people are buying guns. And that's more disconcerting, it seems to me. The gas mask probably won't do you any good. I think there's very high consensus of opinion from experts about that. And simply having the gas mask around the house, having the gun around the house, sends a curious message to children. If there are any young children in the house,
mm-hmm.
They need to feel that they're in a safe environment. And the parents and the adults in the home need to give that sense to them rather than expressing their own fear and panic by way of what they buy. And if they buy guns, of course, they increase the probability of an accident from the gun. I mean, it baffles me what people think they're going to do with these guns, but that's another matter. You know, over the last 40 years, what's the number now? About 1 million Americans have died from firearm homicides and suicides and accidents, and we know that the probability goes up when there's a gun in the home, in particular, or clearly when the owners have not had adequate training in the use of the gun. So it sort of depends upon what you're doing to kind of try to protect yourself, I think.
And it's not as though we're looking at a ground invasion by Al-Qaeda or any other terrorist force. We're talking with Barry Glasner, professor of sociology at the University of Southern California. He's author of The Culture of Fear, Why Americans Are Afraid of the Wrong Things. And with our special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty, we're looking at the climate of fear that's developed in the United States since September 11th and somehow seems to be heightened this week. We want to hear from you. Is it too much? Are you beyond it? Are you done with it? Let us know. You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. You can learn more about anthrax and how it affects the body. Log on to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage, or join the conversation online at WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. This is Special Coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the culture of fear that's percolating just below the surface and sometimes above it in the United States these days in the wake of terrorist attacks and the warnings of potential for more. I'm joined by Barry Glassner, professor of sociology at the University of Southern California, and our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jack, I was wondering as we went into the break, these warnings from the government have been so strong and yet so nonspecific. And I can't help but just wonder, is there a possibility that they're sort of covering here in case there is something? They don't want anyone to say that we weren't warned.
Yeah, that's occurred to me, too, just because of the nature, the sort of two-handed nature of it. On the one hand, it's a grave threat. On the other hand, we don't know where or how. It would be a way of saying, well, we at least knew it was coming. And maybe there's even some national purpose in that. One of the, as we've said again and again on this show, and as all Americans realize, our intelligence services failed us miserably, tragically, historically. And to gain confidence, to regain confidence in them, even in this way, may have some, well, there's at least a rational need to be more confident in them, presumably if their performance justifies that. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's... There may be a kind of a bureaucratic imperative in that, too. And I wonder, too, if it's also a signal to Americans abroad, you know, just to be – especially there, to go to the American embassy, to look where they are. I've heard that in Jakarta that, you know, there was a sort of looking around at hotels where people were talking about storming hotels where Americans were staying. This – people are vulnerable there much more than they are here, it seems to me.
We're talking about vulnerability and fear in the wake of terrorist attacks. How are you feeling about it? Are you jumpy? Are you jittery? Are you cool? Do you think it's all overblown? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. Mark is on the line. Welcome, Mark.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'll get right into it. I agree with very much with the previous callers about the risk of just living in general.
So you don't feel it's greater today than it was a month and a half ago?
Well, I mean, not really. I mean, in truth, I'm far more afraid of my government's response to terrorism than I am to terrorism itself.
What aspects of that response concern you?
The Office of Homeland Security seems very McCarthyistic. And
that's what keeps you up at night.
I mean, I believe with Franklin, you know, when you trade your freedom for security, you wind up with neither freedom or security. And I think that these little inconveniences that the president talks about are going to not be short term at all.
Mark, thanks for your call. Barry Glassner, what about the profile of Americans? How ready do you see Americans as a sociologist to surrender freedoms for security?
Not very willing at all. Depending on what sorts of freedoms we are asked to give up. I think in terms of what the caller is saying, though, there's something that concerns me, and that is sort of fear mongering or a sense of foreboding about the government with a capital T and a capital G. You know, one thing I found interesting is that seems to shift back and forth every decade or two, between liberals and conservatives and the right and the left. And, you know, we've come from a long period now where conservatives and the right have been doing a lot of fear mongering about government. Now they love government. I'm hearing from the left and the liberal side all sorts of fears of government. And, you know, those fears, when they're blown out of proportion, can be quite detrimental as well. I think, you know, in terms of which changes are going on, what this legislation contains, we need to look at the specific provisions and see if the changes are of the sort that should concern us. And again, we need to rely on watchdog organizations that are concerned with this and congressional leaders who are concerned with these issues to help us out with that.
What keeps you up at night? We're at 1-800-423-8255. All this week, there's been a steady drip of news of new events, anthrax in Florida, and today anthrax in Manhattan. That's the center of a lot of population. Are you worried about it, or does it seem something that's pretty much under control? Call us. Let us know what you think. Don is on the line. Welcome, Don.
Hi. So I was just curious about some of the statements were made that it seems like it's a new phenomenon that people are running out and buying gas masks and what have you. But it seems to me that it sort of parallels what happened when there was the threat of nuclear war. People are, you know, building bomb shelters and stocking food and so forth. And that was one thing that we've dealt with. And people sort of dismiss some of the terrorism we've had in our own country, like Oklahoma City and the Columbine shootings, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a good point. Let me put that one to Jack Beatty. And thanks for your call, Don. Jack, how does this seem to you to compare to the era of A-bomb fear, of nuclear warfare fear, when kids had to run in the hall and cover their heads, and people did indeed dig bomb shelters into the corners of their cellars? How does this compare?
Yeah, that bomb shelter thing especially, I mean, there was something about that. I mean, I remember an article in Life magazine showing not only the bomb shelter, but the man with the shotgun who was ready to keep his neighbor out of the bomb shelter. That's what fear can do, isolating people. You were going to sort of solve the nuclear problem yourself by building a bomb shelter and getting a shotgun to keep your neighbor out of it. That's that kind of atomizing, anti-democratic effect of fear. But, you know, when you look back on the nuclear age, we're not out of it entirely, but you look back on the, it was a balance, there was a balance of terror. We could destroy them, they could destroy us, mm-hmm. and therefore there was a kind, deterrence had a kind of comfort to it once you thought it through. They didn't want to die, so they wouldn't attack us, and we didn't want to die, so we wouldn't attack them.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a kind of, bizarre rationality that took the imagination of Stanley Kubrick to show just how weird it could be in Dr. Strangelove, mm-hmm. where, you know, doomsday machines on either side meant to sort of increase credibility. Actually guaranteed destruction. So there was nothing fundamentally rational about it, but this is something different.
This time it's asymmetrical, the phrase we always keep hearing. So the stakes are not the same for both sides, and it seems less grounded, doesn't it?
Less grounded, but more threatening in a way. I mean, for one thing, these people aren't deterred by the thought of death, and so the rational, you know, deterrence model doesn't work at all. And secondly, it's already happened. It's happened here, and the nuclear bomb didn't happen here. It happened in Japan, and that just makes such a difference in the sort of resonance and the quality of the fear we're experiencing.
Boy, it sure does. We're talking about fear. We're talking about even panic. How closely are you paying attention to every bit of new threatening news that comes out? Is it getting to you? Do you feel a tremor of panic? We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Rob is on the line. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
Well, I was just listening to the show here and, you know, going back to the whole topic about flying. I mean, I think that the element of surprise for terrorism on airplanes and air flight around the country is really gone, you know. And I think that you just mentioned something that a lot of these stories that are coming in through CNN and everything else with anthrax and all the rest of it is a drip, drip. And I think that the government has taken a stand at this point that, you know, they're not going to be able to do large-scale things like that. And that,
you mean to stop the threat?
Yeah, I think the threat relative to airline security.
Oh, you're saying it's diminished at this point by the security measures that have been taken. Mm-hmm. So you're feeling better.
I think that people's heightened awareness of what's going on around them mm-hmm. will eliminate that threat completely. It's been proven a couple of times where there's been, you know, passengers have rallied mm-hmm. and stopped incidents from happening on airplanes. And, you know, being more aware of what's going on around you is half the situation here, you know. And
yes,
what's that?
We hear that again and again. Rob, thanks for your call. Jack Beatty?
Yeah, and yet we heard from the Attorney General today that I think it was something like 9 or 10 of the top 20 airports still we're not taking proper security steps with regard to luggage and the possibility of explosion. So I don't know that that hypothesis is correct. That if this is still going on, if the machinery has been so slow to respond that even air traffic is not yet what we could call safe. If the Attorney General can say that these airports are not performing proper security, and one of them was Boston's airport, are not performing their security. Office.
And there you've got it in a nutshell. We're all wrestling with what is the appropriate level of concern, of fear, versus the information we're getting about how safe or unsafe we may be. Barry Glassner, you've looked at this. if we don't have major new attacks, and knock wood, and we all pray that, somehow those are avoided, how long do cycles like this tend to run? We're revved up to a pretty high level of tension here. How long will it go? How often does it need new fuel to stay at this level?
I think we can't actually answer that question because of something that was brought up earlier. There's been a major change in this country because we had this attack on our soil. And we have believed very deeply and with good reason for a long time now that that couldn't happen. And so I think we're in a new era in that sort of way. Now, in terms of the height, this sort of constant sense, this sort of environment, you know, that there's something happening every few minutes and anything could happen at any second, I think that will certainly dissipate at some point. But the larger sense of concern about this and that we can never be quite certain in the way we were before, I think is going to last a very long time this time.
Barry Glasner, thanks very much for joining us. Barry Glasner is professor of sociology at the University of Southern California. Jack Beatty, do you see an island of an oasis of peace of mind out there somewhere?
No, but I take comfort from the past. Here is Franklin Roosevelt speaking on March 4, 1933. This great nation will endure as it has endured, will revive, and will prosper. The only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
That's it. Thank you, Jack, for being with us. And thank you, Barry Glasner. You can continue this conversation online. Share your fears, share your thoughts, share your confidence with other listeners. Go to WBR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Now, a renewal of faith. Susan Richmond is the associate vicar of the Old North Church in Boston. Many know it as a famous landmark and a tourist destination. Reverend Richmond says that in the current crisis, many have rediscovered it as a house of worship.
In some ways, it's been very good to have the work that I have to do because from a faith perspective, it sort of keeps me in line. And having a place to come to talk to other people about what's been happening, as well as to have a place to open our doors for other folks to come in. So, you know, there's the personal level. Sometimes I go home at night and crash a little bit. But during the daytime, it really has been a good thing to have a place to go, to have our candle lit, to keep that hope that there will be peace, and then in the long run that, you know, the good will prevail. The first few Sundays we were mobbed. That sort of waned a bit. It's not quite as strong. But what we have found is a number of younger folks, younger meaning in their 20s and 30s, coming to church and looking for a place to put their faith into action. So a number of people interested in social outreach, I know how can they get involved, and we're trying to do whatever we can to encourage that. And it's definitely been more somber, more thoughtful, and at the same time, a real sense of continuity. Life goes on. With a parish, you know, you have people who've known each other forever as well as newcomers coming in, so this overwhelming sense that of the continuity that life will go on, and there's going to be a baptism in a few weeks, and all of that sort of helps us keep our perspective, I think. And particularly since the September 11th, I mean, willing to sit in silence a little bit, question their faith, question where God is, and all of that to me says that God's right in the middle of it. When we have prayed, we have taken sort of a version of the Lord's Prayer that was we found somewhere and used it as a litany, asking God to help us in response to this. And one of the things we've prayed for those who have done the bombings as well as those who haven't. And that's sort of one of the basic tenets of our faith, that we can pray for our enemies, which is a very difficult thing at this time. And yet, it seems to me probably one of the most crucial things that we can be doing. As an individual, I think I probably have some of the apprehension that everyone has, and yet I keep seeing this renewal of faith that seems to be coming to people. I face life saying that goodness is going to prevail.
Susan Richmond is associate vicar of the Old North Church in Boston. We'd like to hear from you. How has your life changed since September 11th? Send your submissions for future radio diaries by email to special@wbur.org. To listen to or read some of the radio diaries featured on special coverage, go to our website, log on to WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR in Boston.